Good afternoon. This is the session, the Lacey Act and Home and Housewares Business. I'm going to introduce you to Craig Brightup. He is the International Housewares Association Washington representative, and he's going to introduce our other speakers and the topic. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Mike. My name is Craig Brightup, and I, along with my partner, Rafe Morrissey, represent the IHA, International Housewares Association, in Washington, D.C., and we have covered an awful lot of issues over the years, but then we learned, frankly, we like to think we know everything, but it's a little tough to know everything, and you got to be prepared for issues that could have a direct impact on the people that you represent. And fortunately, we have someone here as our speaker who knows everything about the Lacey Act. Now, Rafe and I have covered a lot of turf over the years in different agencies, but I've got to admit neither one of us has done much work with the Fish and Wildlife Division of the Department of Agriculture or the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service. It sounds like something that is just almost a non sequitur. I assure you that after you've had a chance to see this presentation and see what's coming, you may realize that the products you make are covered by this, and this is a very, very serious topic. Our speaker today is Ashley Amidon. She is the executive director of the International Wood Products Association. She does a whiz-bang job, and she knows all about it to the point where she has been able to get grants from the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service and others to spread the word, to be prepared for what's coming. So I am very pleased that we have her here today. Ashley, come on up and tell us what we need to know. Ashley Amidon.
Thank you. So before I start, just a quick raise of hands, and there aren't that many people in here, so should be pretty quick. How many people are familiar with the Lacey Act? You've heard of it before. Okay, how many people feel very confident that you know about the Lacey Act and how it applies to your business? Great, that's all I needed, because I want to make sure that I'm giving you the level of information that is helpful for you. So I will ask that you hold questions until the end. I've got some time set aside. We'll have plenty of time to walk through anything you need. I also have business cards up here, and this presentation can be shared. You're also welcome to take pictures during. Nothing in here is terribly secret. Okay, so I'm not going to read all this, but I do need to give a couple disclaimers. I am not from the government. I am not a lawyer. I do not play either of those things, even on TV. So I am going to give you a trade perspective today on the Lacey Act. The presentation you're about to see is part of an outgrowth of our education system, which was built using seed funding from Rural Resources Institute, the US government. And as Rafe mentioned, I am here today as part of a grant from a USDA APHIS, which is the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service. But again, this is not official legal guidance. You can, I'm sure, find a very high priced lawyer to help give you that. So here's what we're briefly going to cover today. We're going to talk about Lacey Act history, the 2008 amendments, which is the reason I am here, what is in and what is out, the declaration form, jails, fines, and other really fun enforcement topics, what does compliance look like, what do you need to know about complying, and then time for questions. So, first of all, blame the ladies. I know I'm saying that in front of you as a woman, but the reason that we have the Lacey Act is actually because turn of the century, not the 2000s, I'm talking about the last one, the fashion was for women to have giant hats with tons of feathers. They had whole birds sometimes, and these birds were being hunted almost to extinction. And so there was a public policy movement to protect birds because individual states were passing laws. It was a patchwork. People were trafficking these birds over state lines. And so Congressman John Lacey, who was an avid naturalist conservationist, put together a legislative effort that led to the passage of what is called the Lacey Act. Originally, the Lacey Act only dealt with birds and really was focused on that interstate commerce issue. It has been amended 6 times. There's been a lot of new things that came in around about the 80s. They brought in seafood. If you do a search for Lacey Act right now and do like news articles, you're going to pull up a lot of stuff about shrimping and fishing. They also changed so that it has both individual and corporate responsibility. It's not just on the person doing it, but if they are, you know, employed in a company, if the company is selling, that whole corporation has liability as well. 2008 is sort of the magic year. Cast your minds back. We all had flip phones. Britney Spears was popular. And Congress actually passed legislation. All crazy. That is when Congress passed the Farm Bill that included plant and plant products. This is where the Lacey Act starts to cover wood. And I always want to talk about the history because I think a lot of times people think that this is a very new law. It's not. We're looking at 124 years at this point of case law, of political sensibilities. So this is something that is very well established, even though plant and plant products were only added in 2008. So I mentioned they're added in 2008. There is a new element that is added to Lacey Act compliance at this time, and that's called the PPQ 505. Conversationally, we call it the declaration. Essentially, what this does is it adds a requirement that you have to file paperwork when you import plant or plant products. At their most basic level, and I'm not going to read the whole bill for you, but the Lacey Act amendments of 2008 say you cannot bring in any plant or plant products that were illegally taken, right? So I think a lot of us in our head have an idea of what illegally taken means, right? Like you go under the cover of night and you're harvesting trees from land that isn't yours, or you're stealing it from someone's store. That's obviously illegal. What about if the company owes back taxes? What if the driver gets a speeding ticket on the way to the port because he's running late? What if you have human rights violations in the area? What if you have HR issues? All of that makes that product illegal. So I wanted to make sure to sort of level set what are some of the products that you all trade in that are going to be covered by the Lacey Act. So kitchen tools, cutting boards, spice mills, baskets, bamboo products, which we're going to talk a little bit about, and essential oils. Essentially, if it's a plant or plant product, it is covered, full stop. End of discussion. So there are two primary responsibilities under the Lacey Act when it comes to plant and plant products. The first is to conduct legal trade. This is for the entire supply chain. I talk with a lot of companies that say, well, I'm not the importer of record. I don't have to worry about some of this stuff. That is not how the Lacey Act works. Everyone in the entire supply chain is liable. If you have something that happens overseas and you're 4 steps down the road, does not matter, you are still liable. The other thing to know is that a Lacey Act declaration is a separate responsibility. If you trade in plant or plant products, you have been covered by the Lacey Act since 2008. However, you may not have been filing declarations because USDA APHIS has employed a phased-in approach for people to file paperwork. So a lot of folks don't realize that they're covered by the Lacey Act because they haven't had to file those declarations, but it is coming for you. So I already talked about, if it's illegal in one place, it's illegal everywhere, right? There is no certain amount of steps you can go along a supply chain and suddenly something becomes legal. It is all the way to the consumer. Lacey is a strict liability law. You do not have to know about the crime being committed to be found guilty. So this law does not play around. So what does this mean for you practically? You have to know your supply chain, you have to know your product, and you have to know your supplier. We remember this as source, species, supplier. It's pretty easy to remember, right? Those are the three priorities you have to look at when you're looking at Lacey Act compliance. So let's talk about what's in and out, because there are a few, I don't want to call them exceptions, but things to be aware of. So pallets, this is a question I get all the time, right? Because so many shipments use wooden pallets. So pallets used for dunnage, they do not need a declaration. However, if you are bringing in, say, a container full of pallets that you are going to sell, those do need a declaration. So if it's being used in the stream of commerce as its intended purpose, no declaration. If you're bringing it in bulk, declaration. Common cultivars. So this was a way to get around the fact that we have a lot of food crops, for example, that are considered a plant or a plant product, right? So APHIS has a link, and when you look at this presentation, that's actually a hyperlink. It will take you to a list of common cultivars. You can type in whatever the product is, and it will pull up an individual entry, and it will tell you what part of the plant is covered. So for example, I know in the description for this, olive oil was listed, right? If you type in olive, oil, seeds, not covered. Olive wood is covered. So if you're bringing in olive oil, you don't need a declaration. If you're bringing in an olive wood cutting board, you do. So it's important for you to check your products by species to find out if they qualify as a common cultivar. Also worth mentioning, I don't know if anyone here trades in CITES, which is a Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, things like mahogany, jatoba, really. It's a very specific list of woods. This does not give you a free pass. I've talked with some folks that assume that because they have a CITES permit, they don't need to do anything else. That is not the case. LACI is all-inclusive. I do want to talk about bamboo, because I know there's a lot of bamboo products in this industry. So this is directly from the APHIS guidance, and again, that's a hyperlink down at the bottom. So if you are using cultivated bamboo, essentially you have a bamboo plantation that is being raised specifically and exclusively for commerce, then that is not covered by a declaration. However, if you're using wild bamboo, it's a mixed-use product, or you don't know, you do have to have a declaration for that. So it gets back to the idea of knowing your supply chain, right? You need to be able to say with certainty that yes, this bamboo cutting board, for instance, comes from 100% plantation cultivated bamboo, and therefore I do not need a LACI Act declaration. And if you cannot say that with 100% certainty, you better file a declaration. I always tell people, when in doubt, file a declaration. It's extra paperwork, but it's not a huge amount, and it can save you. So let's talk a little bit more about this declaration. So I've mentioned there is a phased-in approach. So we are about to enter phase 7, which is going to pull in all of your products, which is why I'm here today. The first phase was things like wooden logs. So my industry has been covered since 2009. We're kind of old hat at this, which is why we're the ones starting to do education, because there's no need for you all to reinvent the wheel. We can help. This phase 7, which will bring in all of your products, it's expected in the Federal Register within the next 1 to 2 months. APHIS will then have a 6-month implementation period. So you're looking at sometime in Q3 or Q4 of this year, you will be required, or the importer of record will be required, to file a declaration with every single entry. There will be no exceptions. You don't get to, you know, extend the timeline or anything like that. They are going to be phasing this in pretty quickly. And it's expected to cover all plant and plant products except purely composite wood products. So APHIS has listed examples of what composites include from their perspective. So that's paper, paperboard, particle board, medium and high density fiberboard. That's it. Everything else is covered. So if you have any products that are not on this very specific list down here, you will be filing a declaration by the end of this year. So this is a little bit about the PPQ 505. This is what it looks like. And we're going to go through some of the elements in a minute, but I wanted to show you what a form looks like. So you can file this in a couple ways. You can file it through the customs broker system, ACE, or you can also use the absolutely beautifully designed government system called LAWGS, L-A-W-G-S. Little slow, little clunky, but it gets the job done. When we first started filing declarations, my industry was filing these exclusively on paper because that's the only way the federal government took them. So this is actually leaps and bounds ahead of where we were. So what's included on it? There's two broad categories. One is basic business information about the shipment, and then you have the sort of very specific information about the wood or product. So these are some examples of that basic business information, right? They need to know who is importing, where you are, you know, the container information. You got to have the contact information for the importer on record, bill of lading, HTS code, very basic stuff. This is, I think, where it can get a little bit scary for people. So you need scientific names. There are a lot of woods that are traded, and they have a trade name, right? Or you have a brand name. That is not sufficient. You need species and genus. So you need someone in your, you know, if you're an importer in your importing department, if you are not an importer in your buying or international sourcing department, who understands scientific names for wood. Because this is important from an accuracy perspective. You also need to know country of harvest, obviously the quantity that you're bringing in, and then the value of the product. So, I mentioned the strict liability law. The Lacey Act does not specify what due care is. They don't tell you what to do to comply. How do you know your supply chain, right? They basically just say, don't import illegally taken plant or plant products, the end. Well, that's not enough if you're doing business, right? You need specifics. You need to know what questions do I ask, what paperwork am I looking for, all of those things. The Lacey Act does not provide that. However, and we'll talk to in a little bit about the enforcement cases that have occurred, every time there's an enforcement case, the government asks more and more. So we in the industry have started to view these enforcement cases as a pretty good guidebook for some of the things the government is looking for. It is not enough to sort of check off the things, you know, that are included in an enforcement case, because some of that is going to be specific to that company or specific to what they did wrong. But you start to see some commonalities across all of the enforcement cases that you can draw lessons from and use in your own due care compliance process. Speaking of enforcement, here's what violations will cost you. And they, I believe, just in or will be increasing this summer to keep pace with inflation. So these numbers are going to go up just a little bit by the time everyone in this room is filing for declarations. So you have civil, criminal, and criminal felony. And I think I have a little pointer on here. Here you go. So this is, civil is the defendant should have known, essentially negligence. And again, does not depend on the defendant's knowledge of illegality. So if you have something in one of your stores or in this very trade show, and the government says, hey, this is illegal, and you're like, well, I didn't know that, does not matter. You can still and will be charged under civil. Then you have criminal misdemeanor. So this is the defendant should have known. And then criminal felony, the defendant knew. And when we look at the enforcement cases, you'll see there's a wide range of where people fall in these. By the way, we're only going to talk about five enforcement cases. These are the big ones. There are tons of very small cases that happen all the time. Either very small fines or denial of entry or something is destroyed at the port, right? So don't think that there's only been five enforcement cases. These are just the really big ones where we're looking at hundreds of thousands and or millions of dollars in fines. So let's talk about those costs. So these are the big four, and then I'll verbally talk about the fifth because it just happened about a month ago. So the first, and this is the one that you may sort of cast your mind back and have heard something in the news about Gibson Guitar, that was the Lacey Act. The federal agents raided Gibson's factory in Nashville, guns, everything, seized computers, you know, it was a media firestorm. And you know how I talked earlier about the whole supply chain, right? Gibson was not the importer of record. A lot of people don't know this. Gibson bought from the importer of record. It was a tiny one-woman shop called Luthiers International. The US government went after Gibson. And I always want to point this out when I'm talking to businesses, because what this demonstrates so clearly to me is that the US government is going to go after any allegation of wrongdoing, right? Like Luthiers International didn't get away scot-free. But we don't talk about the Luthiers International case. It wasn't the Luthiers International person that was paying these massive fines and going to jail, or facing the prospect of going to jail. It's Gibson Guitar, because they're a big name brand, they have deep pockets. So if you're sitting here thinking, I have some protection, right, because I've got two or three or four steps between me and the importer of record, you need to be careful because you probably have deeper pockets than that importer of record. And they're going to go after where they can get the most money and make the best case. So it's worth noting, so this was 2012. They had a deferred prosecution agreement, five-page compliance plan. They had 350K penalties and community service. I was actually with IWPA at this time. I was their lobbyist. And I remember coming into the office, and my boss at the time, it was like, I think the raid happened, it broke the news like 10, 10:30 in the morning. And all of a sudden, he like yells for me across the hall. And he was a pretty quiet spoken guy. So I was like, oh God, like something's on fire. Rush in, and he's like, one of our members just got raided. Like, that's not anything you ever want to have happen as a company, as a trade association, just as an industry, right? Because it tars a whole industry in consumers' minds. It tars a whole product. So it's pretty scary when one of these happens. The next one is J&L Tonewoods. This is actually a domestic case because the Lacey Act doesn't just apply to imports. Remember all the way back in our little history lesson, right? It originally looked at interstate commerce. So this, I believe it was either father and son or brothers, family company, they were stealing wood out of a U.S. national forest and selling it across state lines. So it was only, like, I think, like a two- or three-person company. You got 1 year in prison, additional probation, about 160K in restitution. That company is unsurprisingly out of business. Our third case, Lumber Liquidators, another big household name. They've now rebranded as LL, but everyone still calls them Lumber Liquidators, right? So they have a 2016 case. I'm just going to skip right down here and circle with my pointer. Over $13 million in penalties. They also had government-supervised business practices for 5 years. The government does not play around, and if you're noticing, every one of these is getting a little bit longer and a little bit more in-depth, right? So Young Living, 2017, this was Essential Oils. Again, government-supervised business for 5 years and a 22-page plan versus that 8-page plan the year before. They actually found out they were doing something illegal and voluntarily self-reported to the government. And that is the reason they only had 760K in penalties. This is what voluntarily reporting gets you. The government was very lenient with them because the essential oils industry had not really been keyed into Lacey. They just weren't aware of some stuff. That's obviously changed now. But when in doubt, if you think that your company is doing something wrong, if you know it is, you are better off to report to the government so that you are looking at less than $1 million versus 13 plus. Now, I don't have it up here yet because they just got sentenced on Valentine's Day. There was a lovely couple in Florida that was just sentenced for $43 million because they were evading duties. AD/CVD duties, they were importing product from China and transshipping it and, you know, saying it was coming from different countries to try to avoid paying the tariffs on Chinese products. And they were caught. And you might be thinking to yourself, but that's an anti-dumping countervailing duty, right? No, because that product is illegal. It's also a Lacey Act violation. So if you violate any one law, you can slap a Lacey Act violation on top of it. So if you violate TSCA, if you violate harvesting, if you violate any of the things we've talked about here, it can also be a Lacey Act violation. So what does this mean practically for you now that I've scared everybody? Your company obviously has to care about these things, not only because it's the law and you're legally obligated, but it's also an ethical way to do business. And I'm going to go out on a limb and assume that nobody here wants to trade illegally because you probably wouldn't be at a trade show in a continuing education room if you did. Or you're playing a real long game, I guess. So that means you need to exercise due care. So really, it's all about understanding your supply chain. It's not enough, and I have companies that do this. They put together a really pretty standard operating procedure, and they've got their compliance rules, and then they never touch that again, right? You have to constantly be evaluating your compliance plan. You have to be taking into account new information, and you have to make sure that you're actually following it. It is not enough to have that pretty plan and set it on a shelf, and once a year sort of bring it out, dust it off, be like, oh yeah, still looks good, okay, we're doing great. You have to follow it. So When it comes to due care, this is just a couple top-line things. This is obviously going to be very specific for every company. If you're an importer of record, you obviously have to file the declaration when your product category is covered, right? Full stop. Everyone in your supply chain needs to exercise due care. It cannot just be the importer of record. It will help protect you, obviously, in making sure that you're not importing illegal material. But it's also really helpful because if you can show that you made a good faith effort at conducting due care, that will help you either get lower penalties or hopefully not have to face any illegal actions at all. But if you do get caught up in something, it helps your case if you can show, hey, you know, we visited the supplier, we've talked with them, we have supplier questionnaires, we do all of these things, something slipped through, it happens, the government is going to be more lenient with you. DOJ has actually said publicly multiple times that how much due care a company does is something they weigh when they're looking at Lacey Act violations. So the more you do, the more protection you get. So just to sort of summarize on the due care side, so you want to evaluate, which is reviewing your supply chain for risk, mitigate. If you find risk, because there's always going to be risk, right? There's always going to be a country where you can, that's the only place you can get a product, but you have to make sure you're, you know, staying away from anyone that bribes, right? You got to make sure you're not in an area with armed conflict. Whatever it is, there will be risks in your supply chain. Knowing them and being able to mitigate them is key to conducting due care. And then justify. I have members that every time they start a relationship with a new supplier will justify why they have selected that supplier, right? I went and visited their factory. I did spot checks with their employees. I did a random, you know, not planned visit where I asked to see permits. I asked around with the government, made sure they were paid up on taxes. They will have justification for why they are using that company. And again, it's those three risks. So I'm going to pause a second here. This is a good slide to take a picture of or to remember to come back to if you want to take a look at the presentation later. Because these sort of three and three, these are the basis of all due care programs. Again, what your due care program looks like is going to be unique based on company, supplier, species, right? But all of these elements are going to have to be there. So how do you start? Because there's probably some of you sitting there now going, oh my God, I don't know that we do some of this, and I'm really scared, right? How do you start that? So obviously, you want to communicate your desire. It sounds really basic, right? But you need to be clear with your suppliers in writing, something that you can keep as proof, saying, I want to ensure that I am following all applicable laws in your country and mine. You want to identify the species. Getting back to that, having to fill out the declaration, right? You need to know the genus and species of everything you're trading in. And you also need to ask questions about where the material was harvested, especially if you're further down the chain, and what your supplier's due care system looks like. Because if you ask a supplier, hey, what does your due care system look like? What are you doing for compliance? And they're like, not sure. That's probably a red flag. You consider tracking and traceability issues. There's a lot of new amazing technologies that are out there that are looking at wood ID, wood tracking. I'm happy to talk about that offline with anyone that wants to, but there, I think, are some really interesting technology attempts to look at this tracking and traceability. And if anyone trades into the EU, you're probably already looking at that because the EU is bringing in a regulation regarding any products that are brought into the EU. Every single product has to have GPS coordinates. So if you're trading into the EU, I'm happy to have a conversation with you about that as well. If you have critical supply chain suppliers, you might need greater documentation. What I mean by that is if you have someone that is essential to your business, they're doing a huge volume, they're the only supplier that you have supplying something, right? Like, it is recommended, highly recommended, that you go above and beyond with some of those folks. I already talked about the scientific tools. A lot of the technology advances that are being made in conjunction with universities. So they're collecting wood sampling, stuff like that. So, And then look at what third parties can help you. There are a lot of folks out there that, you know, support the timber industry, whether that's an auditor, you get someone that is a third party auditing company that will audit all of your suppliers every year, every 5 years. You've obviously got lawyers, they're on every industry. Trade associations, to toot my own horn, universities, and even environmental groups. I always want to call out the environmental groups because there are a lot of ENGOs out there that will do occasional reports on sort of legality issues in supply chains. Even if you don't agree with those, it's important to be aware of them. And then just document your research and actions. And of course, taking our training, again. So you can't prove Lacey Act compliance. There is no way for you to say, I 110% have complied with the Lacey Act, right? Because there's always going to be facts that you don't know. You aren't watching the tree grow, like camping out by it, and then watching it get cut, and then taking it yourself to the container, right? Like, you're not going to be there every step of the way. So you have to figure out what is the best way that you can approximate that 100%. I also want to point out there's no checklist. There's no document or set of documents. There is no magical key that if you do these things, you will be compliant with the Lacey Act, right? I always like to talk about it as compliance is learning to ask the right questions of the right people, because that's going to vary wildly depending on how long you've known a supplier, what you're trading in, where it's coming from. But making sure that you know what to ask for and who to ask it from, that is going to be the formation of a very good due care program. And I already just said that, so. Okay, so I think I have time for a little bit of a pop quiz. I'm not going to like call on you individually, don't worry. So here is a very simplified supply chain. So you have a concession owner, right? Someone that owns the forest in another country. You have someone that comes in and harvests it. Then they sell to someone who processes a little bit. Then they sell to another company who's going to be, you know, trading. And then they sell to an exporter. And at that point, it goes to the U.S. importer of record. Right now, it's being brought into the United States. They sell to another company. They sell to a processor. They sell to a finisher. Then they sell to a big brand name company, right? And then they sell to the consumer. Nothing crazy. But oh no, someone broke the law. Our concession owner, right? They're like, oh man, kind of having a bad year. Timber prices aren't where I want it to be. I'm going to walk into my next door neighbor's land because they're not around that much. It's dark. They won't notice. I'm going to harvest a couple trees, right? Well, maybe I'm going to harvest a lot of trees. No one's stopping me. I'll just harvest them all. All right, so there's illegality at the front end of the chain. Where does liability rest? Who is in trouble under the Lacey Act? If you have an answer, feel free. I won't make fun if it's the wrong one. Yes, it's everyone, right? Because it's tainted from this point on. Now, do you think the processor down here knows who this is? No, most of the time they don't, right? But that's the point of due care. Because in every step in this chain, right, so the harvester, they're going to be the ones directly talking to the concession owner, right? Initial processor going to the harvester, each back. Quite frankly, if you're the importer of record, you should be investigating this whole chain here. And if you're this brand name company, if I were you, I'd be going back through the entire thing, right? Because it's for every step here, it's your reputation on the line. So just think, if you're that brand name company, how many steps back you're going to have to go? How much paperwork? How much staff time? It's unfortunate, but it is necessary. So I have a trick question. You guys got it. Congratulations. But I did get to finally break out those great PowerPoint skills and make the color change. So what about prosecution? Where do you think the U.S. government's going to go? They can go all the way to the consumer under the Lacey Act. No, it's unlikely. I'm going to be very honest. It is very unlikely that the U.S. government is going to go into Rafe's house and be like, Rafe, you bought an illegal guitar in 2007 that you said you were going to learn to play, but you like definitely didn't, so it's in the closet. You're in trouble now. That's exceedingly unlikely. technically they can do it, but I'm going to be honest, it's probably not going to happen, right? Now, the other thing to keep in mind is it's hard for the US government to go after other countries. It's possible. You can look at extradition agreements if they're a US citizen. That most recent Lacey Act case I mentioned, it was an American couple. They fled to Europe. It was like a really bad spy movie. They were like getting fake passports in Serbia and then moving their money to Montenegro, right? They got extradited back to the US from Montenegro. So it's possible, but it's unlikely. And it's not probably not going to be the consumer either. So that leaves the US supply chain. So again, I want to be very clear, under the Lacey Act, the government can go after these, but it is more likely that they will hit this US supply chain. So, yes, let me say it. Oh, hello, Peter. That's right. I only saw like this much of you on a Zoom screen.
Peter.
Brand name company might be a little vague. Is okay. It the mark, the brand that sells to the retailer, or is it the retailer?
So it can be either one. In this simplified example, I just picked brand name company, and in my head, I was like, it's Home Depot, it's Home Goods, it's, or it could be, you know, Cabinet Works, right? Or, you know, whatever. It's just, you're there at some point in the chain, there will be, this good will become branded, right? It will stop being a random kitchen cabinet and become a master brand
cabinet. But in our world, that's not the end of the supply chain to the consumer. There's generally another step, and that would be the retail company.
Yes.
So do they both? I guess the reason I'm bringing it up, with all the nuisance lawsuits that this industry is dealing with, the way the legal firms that are going after the brand name companies are putting pressure on those companies is by going after their retail customers, mm-hmm. just as significantly, and that puts pressure on the supplier.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, now my retailer's got a problem with me, and that's going to hurt me for long term.
Yes, yeah. So think of it as any commercial entity, whether it's a retailer, whether it's a name brand company, it doesn't really matter. It's anyone that is in the supply chain that is exchanging goods and services for money.
Is there a way to facilitate all those steps? Is there a shortcut?
Not really. I mean, the way the Lacey Act is structured is every single step has equal responsibility to check the supply chain that has come before you. There's no way to transfer that liability. There's no way to shortcut it. It is simply you have this responsibility under the Lacey Act, and that's all there is to it. So all of this, by the way, this is current because everyone is covered by the Lacey Act in this room, right? It's only when you start the change that's coming in this year is going to be the declaration. Now, that is an enforcement tool, right? Because that is a way for the government to, say, check, they say they're importing this species from this country, but species isn't in that country, or there's not very much of it, and they're importing huge volumes. We need to dig a little deeper. I sat through a fascinating presentation from the Department of Justice, and by fascinating, I meant it will give me nightmares for years, and they talk about the ways that they build a Lacey Act prosecution. And they basically compared it to when a cop knows that someone, like a car looks dodgy, but they don't really have a reason to pull them over until they see that the taillight's out, right? And when the taillight's out, then they're talking, and I'm gonna pick on Rafe again because he's right here and I know his name. You know, Rafe, you're looking a little twitchy there, like a little sweaty. Why don't you step out of the car? We got some questions for you. Oh, what is that in the back seat, right? It's a follow-on effect. So the declaration is not the only sort of toehold the government can have, but it is a convenient one.
Yeah, I just had a question about this example. Mm-hmm. This is just one example to confirm the purchasing company processor and finisher could be on the other side of the importer.
Yes.
It would all still apply.
Yeah,
right?
It was. I was trying to simplify it so that folks could understand that there can be many, many steps in a chain that are a lot of different industries, quite frankly, right? Like someone that's processing is not thinking about importing, and someone that's importing is not thinking about the concession owner, right? So it's more just to show that there are going to be a lot of different mindsets and a lot of different business practices and industries that are involved in this, and they still all carry that same liability.
First of all, thank you so much for all of this information. It's been really helpful. As far as the declarations go within the next few months, as you were saying, for stuff that we have in stock right now, like say we're storing it in our warehouse, we would need to go back to those companies and those manufacturers, get that information, and declare all of that right away as far when they...
It depends on where it is. So if it's overseas, at the point of entry, the point of import, is when you file the declaration. If it's already in the United States, you don't need to retroactively file declarations.
Okay, so anything that we have now in the U.S. does
Correct.
Not need to be...
Does not need to declare. It's still covered by Lacey, but it doesn't need to be declared. Okay. It's only from the date of implementation, sometime later this fall. From that point, anything entering the United States will be required to have a declaration, and you will be turned away if you do not have it. So, I haven't seen the Federal Register notice. What that means practically is that you can't wait until 2 days before, right? Because some of that stuff is gonna be on the water for a month or two, depending on where you're importing it from. You need to start thinking about getting that information required for the declaration now.
Okay. Thank you.
No problem.
Any other?
So we've actually had to start doing some of those forms, the PPQ forms.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just because we have a company that's already trying to get ahead for us and get us used to doing it.
That's great.
Is there a best practice for what we, like, if we say we're bringing in cutting boards, is it inches, is it kilograms, is it, like, is there a best practice for what we're supposed to do in that case of the what the product is supposed to be? And
I'm going to, you know what, actually, it's probably easier if I go back this way. Let me pull up the declaration form for you. Sorry, we're going back in time. There we go.
Because it just says unit, and then when you look on the website, because it's a great government website that tells you no information, you know, they're just like, okay, do I put kilograms? And they have all these examples of things, and it's all over the place, so.
And I'm trying to remember, come up to me afterward, because I can do a Google search, and I can, like, or in my email, and I can get you the answer. I just don't remember off the top of my head, and I know I'm going to look at it and be like, why didn't I remember that? But yes, let me look.
Any other questions? Because... Well, can I ask a quick question? I'm just curious about this. Where does it apply? So say I'm making cutting boards in Michigan.
Yes.
And somebody is illegally harvesting, and I bought from them even though I didn't know it.
Yeah.
And I make the cutting boards in Michigan. Is that liable to the Lacey Act?
Yes.
Okay, so it doesn't matter state lines, it doesn't matter international?
So if it's crossing state lines, if you're within the state, you're going to fall afoul of state laws, that's separate. Right. If it's crossing state lines or crossing the boundary of the United States, that is when it becomes a Lacey Act violation.
Okay, that's what I thought you said, but I wanted to check.
Yeah.
Ashley, I just wanted to follow up on this excellent presentation to ask about the grants that Wood Products Association has managed to get from APHIS. Fantastic. When we first started talking about this, I mean, it's a real feather in your, well, I guess I shouldn't use feather as an example, since
feather
that was
in my hat.
The impetus for the Lacey Act, but it really is a wonderful thing that you're doing. How can people take advantage of these? I know you've got a stamp there.
Yes.
That they can, I believe you've got some of your cards here.
I do.
And other things like that. And I believe the magic word is free.
Free, it's
point.
Free. So Thanks. As part of our grant, thank you for that question that I definitely did not bribe you to ask at the very end of the session. So the US government has given us a grant because, IWPA specifically, because we created education programs beginning in 2015. And they were very frank that they could pay for other people to take our program instead of having to spend 2 years and millions of dollars trying to create it themselves. So we have a grant that runs through September 7th or when the money runs out. And it means that all of our Lacey Act education is totally free right now. So this QR code up here, and I've got business cards that have that same QR code as well as my personal business cards, which you guys are welcome to take. We have online on-demand education on the Lacey Act. It's a 5-module path. You can take it at your own pace. There's little quizzes at the end. Again, totally free. We also have 2 in-person education courses, one in California near LA on June 4th, one in North Carolina near High Point on June 6th. And again, Both are totally free. What I have told people is if you know a couple folks in your company want to take the online course, go ahead and register now, because once the money's gone, it's gone. We have space for, I want to say it's 585 people to take. And we're at the front end now, obviously. You guys are my first speaking engagement on my little roadshow here, but we're already at 150 of those slots are taken. So grab them for your company. There's no time limit. You can start them whenever. You can do them at 2 in the morning. It does not matter.
May I add something? I'm Peter Gianetti with the Housewares Association. Thank you, Ashley. I just got to know Ashley on this matter, you know, within the last month. We pulled this together quickly with help. IHA takes the position of trying to continue to educate the industry on matters such as this. We believe the industry is going to be caught a bit off guard by this right now. I was caught off guard by this. So we're going to do our best. You'll see we'll see a potential webinar. You'll see coverage in Homepage News, which is our B2B trade publication, and other matters, blogs, and things like that. So this is really the first step of the Housewares Association getting to know the extent of this situation. So stay tuned for that. We're grateful that Ashley, on relatively short notice and lots of travel, made the effort to get here today to get us started down this road. Because I got to tell you, if I'm surprised, I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that are surprised too. So thank you. Thank you. And I don't know if anybody else has one more quick question or no. Well, then we'll let you go. Thanks very much.